RSS was founded in 1925. Its ideologues were very impressed by European fascism. The RSS is the most powerful organization in India today. It has a militia, it has schools in which millions of children study. It's a nation within a nation, ready to step out and take its place in the world. In fact, in 2025 will be its 100th year, and perhaps there will be a declaration of India as a Hindu nation.
That's Arundhati Roy, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Arundhati Roy on the RSS, Fascism in India. The realities of India are in sharp contrast with the image it projects internationally. For example, you probably haven't heard of the Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, the RSS. It's an Indian right-wing Hindu nationalist paramilitary organization. The RSS, with its millions of members, exerts enormous influence and power in India. Its political party is the BJP, the Bharatiya Janata Party, led by Prime Minister Narendra Modi. The RSS is the progenitor and leader of a large body of organizations called the Sangh Parivar, which has a presence in all facets of Indian society. The RSS promotes a Hindu supremacist ideology that is intolerant of India's minority communities, especially Muslims. India, particularly under the current regime of Narendra Modi, is, in Arundhati Roy's words, a dangerous place where a deeply flawed, fragile democracy has transitioned openly and brazenly into a criminal Hindu fascist enterprise. Our guest today is Arundhati Roy, the world-renowned award-winning writer and global justice activist. Tariq Ali says of her, she is both loathed and feared by the Indian elite. Loathed because she speaks her mind, feared because her voice reaches the world outside India and damages the myths perpetrated by New Delhi. Among her many books are My Seditious Heart and Azadi. Arundhati Roy was at her home in New Delhi when I talked with her. I asked her if she thought a revolt, like the one in July in Sri Lanka, ousting the regime in that country, could happen in India with Narendra Modi being overthrown. Well, a friend in Chennai in South India asked me to ask you if you thought such a revolt against the Modi regime could happen in India.
Not any time in the near future. Right now, the Indian economy, you know, I mean, while I don't want to make any easy comparisons with what's happening in Sri Lanka, Sri Lanka is a, you know, very tiny country. The Indian economy is in a lot of trouble, and the rage that, you know, kind of surfaces from time to time, whether it's the farmers' movement or whether it's with the recent protests about the change in the laws for recruitment to the security forces, all of those get snuffed out very quickly, and all the anger gets redirected into this Hindu nationalist bigotry, and that game works just fine, you know. So I think we're a long way away from seeing something like that happening. In fact, we are seeing the opposite. We are seeing state government after state government being bought over or toppled by the BJP. We are seeing a consolidation of, you know, the institutions of democracy falling into this ideological sort of tunnel, terrifying to watch this, you know, whatever democracy there was being dismantled. We're seeing absolutely no air movement, airing of opinion possible in places like Kashmir. And you're seeing a lot of violence on the streets. I mean, you know, the regime has certainly captured the imagination of a vast part of this population, including the educated middle class. And of course, the media is completely captured. The courts are behaving in very troubling ways. So, yeah, I'd say that we are very far away from a Sri Lanka type of situation.
Well, I'd like you to talk about the farmers' uprising, the year-long nonviolent action.
Nonviolent on the part of the farmers, not yes. on the part of the state.
Yes, hundreds of farmers were killed by state violence. Yes. But I'll call it a successful action. It remains to be seen if the Modi regime comes back with new laws. But it's interesting. I know that you as a journalist went there, you talked to them, you found out what their demands were. What impressed you about that whole movement, and what kind of lessons can be learned in terms of coalition building beyond farmers? Or was this just a one-off, very, you know, spectacular, but not connecting to anything?
So, David, I don't think of myself as a journalist, first of all, you know. So I didn't actually go there to the protest sites as a journalist. And in fact, I actually kept a little bit away from that movement, simply because I actually have known people who were involved in it for many years. And I have, you know, spoken at meetings in Punjab and so on. And the reason I wasn't going there much was because there was such a huge attempt on the part of the government to paint them as terrorists, as leftists, as extreme, you know, Maoists and so on. And since every adjective has been used on me, I was trying to sort of, you know, stay away and not allow the state to completely paint that movement with people who are recognizably part of other resistances, because I know them well. Of course, there were many, many groups, many farmers groups, some of whom even, you know, are ideologically quite far apart from each other, who all came together in this protest. One of the reasons that it was successful is because there was a huge wealthy middle class of farmers there who had a lot of staying power. And then you had coalitions of, you know, landless labor, Dalit workers of the land who, for example, have major contradictions with land-owning farmers, yet everybody came together because they saw it as an existential threat, what was happening. You had a situation where, in fact, all the other things that I've written about, whether it was the anti-dam movement of the Narmada Valley, whether it was comrades in the forest in central India fighting against the acquisition of indigenous people's lands by big mining companies, or whether it was this farmers' movement that saw its own lands and produce falling into corporate hands. There's a thread that connects all of this. But in the anti-dam movement, and also in the fight that is going on in the forests of central India, you don't have the kind of middle class in the resistance that can sustain a movement on that scale and keep it going. So this was one of the great advantages. Apart from actually forcing the government to actually rescind the three farm laws, that movement also created a new kind of language on the street, a new language with which to address this ugly Hindu nationalist language that has become so acceptable now to the Indian media and to the supporters of the BJP. But that's the strength of the street does not translate into any kind of strength when it comes to elections, even in the Punjab or in UP or anywhere else. So one of the things that we've got to understand is that somehow the electoral process has been captured and compromised. And now whatever change will come from the street, like it did in the farmers' movement.
Now, Rukmini S., an Indian journalist, warns it would be overambitious to hold up the farmers' victory as a sign of things to come. The space for dissent, as you've been commenting, in India has shrunk markedly as the Modi juggernaut has rolled on and emboldened Hindu nationalism. That's her observation. Now, one farmer leader, Balbir Singh Rajewal, said, and I'm quoting here, "We need to transform our movement to remove corporate control of agriculture." And then he adds, "Without removing Modi, this is not possible. It's time to become a united force to save India." Those are fighting words.
Yeah, those are fighting words. And well, the trouble is that when you look at what happened in the Punjab elections, some of the people from the farmers' movement actually stood for elections. They all lost their deposits. In UP too, there was a great hope that the farmers' movement would turn the tide against the BJP and Yogi Adityanath, but it didn't do so, even though one can raise certain questions about the about how that election took place. Nevertheless, like I'm saying, you know, the problem is there are two different things here. One is the street and one is the electoral process. And the electoral process has been captured in a whole lot of ways, beginning with the fact that the opposition parties have run out of money, they have run out of imagination, and they have been in their own time in power. I'm speaking from the Congress to all the other parties, state parties as well, many of them have been so corrupt that they are spongy with compromise, you know, and so they are now being caught in the talons of the Enforcement Directorate, and they are, most of them, basically being blackmailed, and therefore there's no opposition. Secondly, there's a system of secret electoral bonds, which makes the funding of political parties a deeply opaque process. You have the institutions that run the elections completely terrified and beholden to the BJP. And then you have a media which is really like Radio Rwanda. I mean, it's just frenzied, bigoted craziness going on. You know, so to actually remove Modi in an election now looks difficult anytime in the near future. I was speaking somewhere and I said, you know, if you look at something in perspective, like in the 60s, there were revolutionary movements demanding the redistribution of land, the redistribution of wealth. They were demanding land to the tiller. Then in the 80s and 90s, you came to movements like the Narmada movement, where people were merely fighting displacement. They were just saying, at least don't take away whatever little land we have. By the early 2000s, after, of course, the market reforms and things and the disparity you know, of income levels and the kind of devastation of the environment was going at such a pace, people, radical activists, were fighting for the what is called the National Rural Employment Guarantee Act, where they were just saying, can the government guarantee 3 months of minimum wages to a rural family, you know, and that would amount to what a normal middle-class person would spend on a meal in a restaurant in Delhi. And that was considered an outrageous demand. And now we've come down to people just being given rations with Modi's face on it, you know, 5 kilos of atta and 1 kilo of sugar and so on. It's like watching a plane be flying backwards, you know, in reverse gear. And but
you say that plane is going to crash.
The point is that we are also, because of, you know, the nature of people's beliefs in Hinduism and other kinds of spiritualism, a very fatalistic people who seem to so far be able to absorb this punishment in return for some mythic future that lies in the past, you know. So I don't know when that romance, when and if it will end, but at the moment it's in full bloom. So at the moment you're seeing a crackdown of the kind where every activist, lawyers, poets, writers, journalists, intellectuals, they are being hunted down. They are being jailed for, you know, I mean, it's enough, a Facebook post criticizing Modi to, you know, people who have been fighting for the rights of those who've been murdered in, let's say, Gujarat in 2002, you know, the first massacre that took place when Modi had just become chief minister, or the Delhi massacre that took place in early 2020, or the killing of Adivasi people in the forest that goes on and on in central India. But now, even to pursue the normal paths of justice, appeals in courts, appeals in high court, Supreme Court, asking for an inquiry, have become like criminal offenses. So it's a very, very dangerous time.
You mentioned Yogi Adityanath, who's a Hindu monk, and he's the BJP chief minister of Uttar Pradesh, India's most populous state. And it has a large Muslim minority. And this Yogi Adityanath, who has incidentally, I think, been mentioned as a possible successor to Modi.
Frequently.
He has been stoking this Islamophobia, this anti-Muslim hatred, and there have been killings and people burnt alive in Muzaffarabad and elsewhere in that state.
Not just him, David. It's a whole sort of, I mean, it's something that one could almost call a policy. So it's not just him. It's a, you know, in fact, one of the bizarre cases right now is that there's a young journalist and fact checker called Mohammed Zubair, who works for an organization called Alt News, which has been brilliant in just systematically debunking fake news, whichever political party puts it out, you know. And Zubair is now being charged with creating enmity between communities and so on, because he called Hindu leaders who've in the press club of Delhi and other places openly called for the genocide of Muslims. He calls them hate mongers. And for that, he's in jail.
This Islamophobia has long been a tool of, in the Hindutva toolbox, as it were, to mobilize its base. But it's recently added to its repertoire of violence, the bulldozing of Muslim homes and businesses. And you've written about this in Al Jazeera.
That's, I mean, not so new, but now it's being revved up. So basically, whenever Muslims come out to protest, whether it was the sort of anti-Muslim citizenship law, which basically cut the ground from under people's feet, where, I mean, you're supposed to come up with a set of legacy papers, like, you know, the Nuremberg citizenship laws in the 1930s during the Reich. So, you know, there was a huge uprising against that, of course, cut short by COVID. But what Yogi Adityanath, in fact, started it, identifying the people who were at the protest, and without trial without proof, without anything, just sending bulldozers to bulldoze their homes. And recently, the same thing happened because of the people who came out to protest the BJP spokesperson's comments about Prophet Muhammad. But the thing about the bulldozing, I mean, we've seen mass killing, we've seen lynching, you know, people being killed in encounters by police, fake encounters, we've seen false arrests. But the bulldozing is a spectacle in which the public participates, you know, so the media part, you have a bulldozer, it's almost like some divine mechanical god that arrives, an avenging god that arrives, and people are watching, the police are there, the media is broadcasting it, the courts are complicit. So it's a way of drawing all the institutions into the spectacle, the performing fascism, performing fascism in which nothing is illegal, you know. Now you're showing that everything is at our command.
In that Al Jazeera article you wrote on June 17th, you say, to my mind, this marks, that is to say, the bulldozing, this marks the moment when a deeply flawed, fragile democracy has transitioned openly and brazenly into a criminal Hindu fascist enterprise with tremendous popular support. That's pretty stark language.
It's stark, and it's very, it's a, you know, what I find, what is very disturbing is that, you know, I keep talking with my friends in Kashmir about it, you know, that in Kashmir, there's a sense in which you have a state, you have the army, you have the torture centers, you have the control of the media, but, and you have, of course, many compromised people, but you don't have this overwhelming sense that a large section of the population supports all this. Whereas in, you know, in India, we have that sense now that this fascist criminal enterprise does have a lot of popular support, and we can't deny it. It makes you think all the time about how to live in it. What is the moral way to live in it? What is the way to write about it? Because your love for the place, for the people, suddenly getting colored by this horror that people are willing to actually participate in the crushing of another people, you know, whether it's Christians, whether it's Muslims, whether it's people on the left, whether it's writers, and the hatred is so palpable, and so there is a fear too, you know, because people are called out, people are targeted, people are made to understand that we have laws, but those laws are applied differently depending on what's your religion, what's your gender. It's very, very disturbing to live here now, you know, very disturbing. I keep thinking about, like, how did, you know, how Germans went on giving their children piano lessons and, you know, sending them to school and ballet classes while the unthinkable was unfolding. That hasn't happened here. It's not that, even though they are building those huge detention centers and, you know, even though 2 million people have been struck off the citizenship list in Assam, and even though the very foundations of who belongs to this country and who has rights in this country and who doesn't is being questioned. But people who've seen this coming from a long time are now subsumed in it, like drowning in it.
The prime minister, now elected twice, Narendra Modi, former chief minister, as you said, of Gujarat, His millions of followers refer to him as Vishwa Guru, the guru of the whole world. Now, he's not exactly a charismatic orator or a dynamic personality. What's the secret of his attraction to so many millions of Indians?
I don't know. I don't want to use the word charismatic, but no. When he speaks at political rallies, he has this howling, sneering, threatening appeal. And he was called Hindu Hriday Samrat, the emperor of Hindu hearts, after the Gujarat massacre. What is important to remember is, how did he step onto the national stage? In 2001, October, soon after the 9/11 attacks, when the whole world came to some sort of consensus on being Islamophobic, the RSS saw its moment. And Modi was appointed chief minister, not elected, but appointed chief minister of Gujarat. Within a few months, you had the horrible burning of a train in Godhra, where 60 Hindu pilgrims, an arson attack, in which 60 Hindu pilgrims were burned to death. And following that, you had weeks of this pogrom, this massacre of Muslims in broad daylight on the streets in the towns and villages of Gujarat. And Modi was the chief minister, and huge questions have been raised about how the state machinery seemed to have sort of stepped back and allowed this to take place. But soon after the massacre, Modi called for elections. The election commission at the time didn't allow it, but as soon as they allowed it, he won with a huge majority. So the language of revenge, of some sort of historical revenge, the casting of Muslims, most of whom are actually, you know, people who belong to the oppressed castes of India, converted to Islam to escape caste, are cast as the rulers or the descendants of the Mughals, you know. So there's this crazy sort of judo move that happened. And now the Muslims who've been pushed to the bottom of the social ladder, of the economic ladder, they are economically and socially boycotted. You know, I mean, there's nothing new, but they are the great threat and the great enemy and so on.
You're listening to Arundhati Roy on the RSS, Fascism in India. This is Independent Alternative Radio. To get copies of this program, just call us at 1-800-444-1977. We're offering printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program at no charge. Again, that's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Now, Kashmir has a special place, it seems, in the ideology and theology of the Hindutva people. And you write, actually, you came to the University of Texas at Austin in April of 2022, and you said, "What India has done in Kashmir over the last 30 years is unforgivable." Could you briefly describe what India has done over the last 30 years? And what happens on August 5th, 2019, when the Indian Constitution is abrogated and what little autonomy Kashmir had was nullified?
Jammu and Kashmir was theoretically an independent kingdom. And like many, when people talk about, they talk about it as the unfinished business of partition between India and when India, the Indian subcontinent was partitioned into India, Pakistan, and then subsequently East Pakistan became Bangladesh. But the thing is that it wasn't just partition, because partition sounds that like there was a hole and then it was partitioned. Whereas actually there wasn't a hole, there were more than 500 independent princely kingdoms, and it was there was a violence of assimilation as much as a violence of partition. And so the way in which Jammu and Kashmir came to be a part of the Indian Union with very, very specific safeguards, which were written into the Indian Constitution under Section 317. But by 1990, you had a situation where, you know, in the 1990s, as we know, the whole subcontinent was in turmoil. You had what was going on in Afghanistan and those winds blowing through Pakistan into Kashmir. You had here the rise of the wild Hindu fundamentalism, the destruction of the Babri Masjid. And so you had an uprising and you had manipulation of the Kashmir elections, continuous manipulation. I can't explain it more than to say that it was the way in which America behaved in South Vietnam, you know, like with all their puppet governments and their rigged elections and so on. And in 1990, it all rose into an armed uprising, which since then has been put down brutally. And you have, you know, something like 500,000 soldiers, security forces, policing that valley, a valley that is now covered with graveyards and, you know, tens of thousands of people, both security forces and Kashmiris have lost their lives. And then on the 5th of August, arbitrarily, the government abrogated Section 370 and basically turned Ladakh, which was a part of Jammu and Kashmir, into a union territory, and took away the state rights. So they don't even, it's not that they just lost their autonomy, they don't even have the right to vote for a local government now. While that was being done, thousands of people, including former chief ministers, were all locked up. The internet was cut. There was, for months and months, the valley was just locked down with no communication. Nobody knew what was going on, no phones. And now you have a situation of complete terror. You have young students, journalists, photographers, any kind of communication that suggests any form of distress, any kind of dissent, any disagreement, any flagging of the horrors that people are enduring is just smashed with an iron fist. People are in jail, journalists are threatened. I don't know how long you can have, 6 million people living in a situation like that.
And what about the possibility of what is called settler colonialism, that is non-Kashmiris coming into
Part of abrogating Section 370 also had to do with abrogating a law that made Kashmiris stewards of their own land. So now Indians can just, flood in and somehow a sort of population transfer could take place. It's difficult because despite all this, they haven't really managed to completely control the area. So even now, every day you have militant attacks, you have signals that despite all this power and all this iron-fistedness, they have not been able to smash the place and secure it.
Now, there's a constellation of organizations under the rubric of Sangh Parivar. Could you talk about what those organizations are? Obviously, the political party is the BJP and the RSS, the Rashtriya Swayam Sevak Sangh, is its militia muscle, let's say. But what about
No. It's not its militia muscle. The RSS is the mothership. The RSS was founded in 1925. The RSS ideologues were very impressed by European, I mean, later on in the 30s and 40s, by European fascism, particularly by Hitler and Mussolini. Their ideologues have written very openly about how, you know, the Muslims of India, like the Jews of Germany, the BJP is the front desk of the RSS. And then you have a whole lot of other organizations like the Bajrang Dal, the Vishwa Hindu Parishad, and a whole lot of other organizations which are loosely affiliated. And there's a sort of division of labor. But the RSS is the most powerful organization in India today. The most powerful. And you have, you know, all your foreign diplomats, German ambassadors, French ambassadors going there to pay their respects. And the RSS has hundreds of thousands of members. It has a militia. It has women's organizations, farmers' organizations, indigenous people's organizations. It has publishing. It has schools in which millions of children study. It's a nation within a nation, ready to step out and take its place in the world. In fact, in 2025 will be its 100th year. And perhaps there will be a declaration of India as a Hindu nation.
And there'll be an election in 2024, the year before.
2024, there'll be an election. But, you know, obviously, also, they don't need any declarations because the constitution of India has more or less been, you know, sidelined.
Moving to the United States, a country you have visited multiple times, how do you see the world's so-called second largest democracy? The U.S., along with India, Australia, and Japan, leads an alliance aimed at China called the Quad. So India has long abandoned its neutrality and Bandung spirit to become somewhat an instrument of U.S. power in Asia.
The pieces are moving so fast now. I don't know, when you look at Trump and Putin and Modi and Le Pen and all these, you know, fascist characters who've had dealings with each other, who agree with each other. So, you know, Modi was in Texas and Trump, and he jointly addressed this stadium full of, you know, the Howdy Modi moment. And then Trump came to India and had a reverse, you know, stadium full of people, and then came to Delhi and was here when the massacre against Muslims in Northeast Delhi was happening. I mean, I think these quads, things will keep changing, you know, because Pakistan had sort of more or less moved into the orbit of China. So India was needed as the base, you know, the fallback base, which used to be Pakistan against China. But now Pakistan, I mean, Imran Khan is gone. So I don't know whether Pakistan is moving back to American.
You ask, in democracy's failing life, could it be that democracy, the sacred answer to our short-term hopes and prayers, the protector of our individual freedoms and nurturer of our avaricious dreams, will turn out to be the end game for the human race?
So that was written in 2010. Interestingly, way before the BJP came, Modi came to power at the center and the way he did. But I mean, you already saw in India that this kind of completely uncontrolled capitalism was washing through the institutions of democracy, conflating democracy with the free market. You saw the devastation of rivers, of forests, of mountains, of the plundering of land, of mining. So you saw a country colonizing itself in a way, you know, in order to live the dreams of Europe and America. And today you see that, you know, the idea that democracy has been just reduced to the idea of elections. Elections are compromised everywhere. So, yeah, we are in trouble. It's so scary. America is, to the outside world, I think, looking like a place which perhaps will not be able to mend itself. I don't know, even our very sage friends, I don't know about Noam and all of them, but even sage friends talk about the possibility of civil war, you know. But then I say, what, I mean, a civil war suggests that there are some regions or something where people feel, you know, is there. But here, it's as if society is just fragmented and everything is politicized there, you know, through that lens. So I don't know. I mean, I think it's deeply destabilizing and the unstable place now.
It's a very fragile moment, both here and there and all around the world. And you said to, in an opinion piece for CNN, you said the damage to Indian democracy is not reversible. One might be able to say that about the United States as well, the damage done.
Yeah.
By the way, have you seen the movie Don't Look Up?
Yes.
Okay. Because I think there you see the obdurate behavior in denial of a reality that is fast approaching the Earth in the form of a meteor. But climate chaos poses an existential threat to everyone, from New York to New Delhi to New Zealand. Floods, droughts, storms, fires, and record heat waves are almost commonplace, with more in the offing. I often quip that the word unprecedented has kind of lost its meaning, its punch, because every time we hear of a new fire or a new storm or a new flood, the word unprecedented precedes it. It's critically important for the world's temperature not to exceed 1.5 centigrade. The way we are going, we will exceed that in a few years. What are your views about what can be done in the time remaining? Because clearly the clock is ticking.
See, David, I think that, you know, all the things that I do write about, whether it's the, whether you can leave the bauxite in the mountain in Chhattisgarh, or whether it's about dams, or whether it's about, you know, the roads that are being blasted into the Himalayas, glaciers are melting, and so on. Every battle that one fights always ends up with a deep loss of, you know, even though people know that they shouldn't be doing it. You know that you shouldn't be cutting all the forests and mining. You know that you shouldn't be building a dam. You know that you shouldn't be ruining the drainage of a whole plateau. But somehow the danger of climate change is so vast that it doesn't register on our little mind. And so for me, the idea is that that can only be won by legislation of a certain kind. You can't make people feel guilty about driving SUVs if you keep providing them the SUVs. You know, you can't be expecting some moral principle will come and overtake humanity and everyone will behave themselves, you know. That's not going to happen. So I think that everything I write about, in fact, is about climate change. You know, the perspective that one has is about what does this do to this world? What does every single one of these projects do to our imaginations and to that actual place as well? People in this part of the world have been fighting those battles because they're existential battles. They're not theoretical battles. In Europe and so on, now they'll soon become existential battles because of the floods and the heat and the rain. But how many years have people been fighting in the forests, in the valleys, in the rivers. But they were not considered climate activists or environmental activists, or even if they were sneered at for that.
Well, it's hard to ignore the reality when you step out of your home in New Delhi and it's 45 degrees centigrade outside. I mean, that hits you right in the face. And you just endured, I think, one of the hottest summers ever in South Asia and in India particularly.
Almost
50 degrees centigrade. You once told me, I don't believe in speaking truth to power. Why not?
Because power already knows the truth.
Ah.
Yes.
Now, people frequently ask me about your personal safety. The dangers you face. I assume you take precautions, but what about that issue of danger?
Well, look, in my case, people will wonder when I'm talking about all the people who are in jail, all the people who've been arrested, who've been attacked, and being on the A list of anti-nationals, how am I not in jail? You know, it's a dance of, what are the costs and benefits to the regime of going after somebody like me. And I just feel that while one should not be uncautious, I think when they want to do something, they'll do it, you know? So there's no point in getting completely colonized by this fear of what is going to happen. Because, individual people's acts of courage are so important. Like just now, just before we started this interview, I was telling you about a friend of mine called Himanshu, who has been for years fighting this case of a whole lot of indigenous people who were shot in their village. And he was asking the government, to institute an inquiry into the deaths. And the Supreme Court has gone and said that, you're malafide and you're defaming the security forces and you have to pay a fine of 500,000 rupees. Now that's a huge amount of money, and there's no way that he would have that money. But I just saw him tweet. He said, I will not pay that money because if I pay it, it would mean that I'm accepting that I'm doing something wrong. I have done nothing wrong in asking for justice for people who were killed, and I will not pay it. Now, that's such a clear, inspiring act of courage, So I feel it's very important for us not to hunch our shoulders, not to become paranoid, to be careful, to not to be, stupidly brave or anything, to be careful, to be strategic, but to continue to hold our position.
This piece of yours, come September, has spread far and wide. And you say, you conclude your essay with, the time has come, the walrus said, perhaps things will get worse and then better. Perhaps there's a small God up in heaven readying herself for us. Another world is not only possible, she's on her way. Maybe many of us won't be here to greet her, but on a quiet day, if I listen very carefully, I can hear her breathing. Can you still hear her breathing?
I have to listen really carefully. I have to say that was a time when I felt that the injustices and the craziness and the rhetoric and everything was so up on the surface. I felt more hopeful then than I feel now. Certainly, I feel like I don't want to be that person who just being hopeful because that's the position that you take. I go through periods of very deep despair, but I also know that it depends on, sometimes you have to just reduce the scope of the lens you're looking through, and you see people being so brave and so funny and so defiant. But I feel that, you know, it's not just the fascists and it's not just the Hindu fundamentalists and the nationalists that we have to look out for, but even ourselves. There's been so much unpleasantness, division, this everyone locking themselves up into little silos, rattling their cages, locking themselves in and then rattling their cages. But the loss of the idea of solidarity, these are really terrible things, you know. So I do feel that we have also participated in flying that plane backwards.
I occasionally give public talks, and I sometimes conclude with that passage I just read, "The time has come," the walrus said. And, you know, every time I read it, and even now I choke up because it's so beautiful. It's so heartfelt.
Even if it's craft, I mean, we haven't talked about that at all, because fundamentally I'm a fiction writer, and I feel that poetry, literature, the way you build a story, the way you tell a story, the way you construct a sentence, these are all more indestructible than almost anything else. And so to insist on beauty, to insist on the fact that you are going to spend a lot of time trying to create something which presents the world as different from the way people want you to see it, that you notice things that people don't want you to notice. Now, these are acts of resistance for me. They're not sloganeering acts of resistance. They're not marching acts of resistance. If I were to take our conversation into a different space, I would say that I listened very carefully and I heard her breathing and I wrote the Ministry of Utmost Happiness, because that is her breathing. That is the other world that's possible, because not because you have to create it, but because you have to notice it, because it already exists right here. You just have to look for it, you know?
What can people, particularly outside of India, do in current circumstances in terms of affecting in a positive way the descent into authoritarianism that the Modi regime and the BJP represent?
Well, I mean, that's a very broad question, and I can only answer it by saying that just as we need to understand what's happening in the US, people there or everywhere need to understand what's going on in the world, and, you know, not to just automatically participate in this notion of India as this democracy with Bollywood and all these, you know, touchy-feely things. And it's a dangerous place. And if India goes into chaos, as it might, it will have implications for the world. But at the same time, I don't feel that. I think things have gone to a point where, like I said, we can't call it back. We have to go through. We have to go through it. And so all one can ask for is an intelligent understanding of what we are going through, as we should provide an intelligent understanding to others of what they are going through.
Thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you.
You were just listening to Arundhati Roy on the RSS, Fascism in India. Arundhati Roy is the world-renowned award-winning writer and global justice activist. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are an independent, progressive nonprofit in our 37th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Noam Chomsky, Vandana Shiva, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, Angela Davis, and Tariq Ali. And we have a series of programs with Arundhati Roy, as well as her latest book, Azadi. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To get copies of today's program, Arundhati Roy on the RSS, Fascism in India, and for her book, Azadi, just call us at 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are available at no charge. Just call us at 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with sitar maestro Vilayat Khan performing Raga Shree.